Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm Johnny Arola, and this will unfortunately be my last appearance on The Damage Report this week. It is, after all, holiday season, Thanksgiving coming up soon. Also, I'm gonna be getting married, no big deal. But tomorrow, Brett Ehrlich is gonna be hosting the show along with Francesca Fiorentini. So let's keep it real, it's gonna be better than it would be if I were actually here. So definitely, you have that to look forward to. And then later this week on Thursday and Friday, we're gonna be doing some look backs at some of the most important stories that we've covered this year on The Damage Report. There's a good chance you will have missed quite a bit of this, even if you've been watching for a while. So you're definitely gonna wanna tune in either on the YouTube channel or podcast or live for that as well. Throughout the course of the show today, we have Jordan Ewell's gonna be joining us to break down big news of the day, including new reporting saying that Barack Obama is ready to weigh in on the Democratic primary, but only if a certain candidate makes it into first place. So we'll tell you all about that a little bit later on. We've also got Jose Caballero is gonna be joining us once again, a candidate who's gonna be talking about student loan debt cancellation, as well as Donald Trump's war on the military leadership that's going on right now. And then we're gonna be closing out the show with just about the saddest story I've talked about in quite a while, which involves a koala named Lewis. Very sad, but you should still stick around and find out what's going on there because it is important. But before all of that, we're gonna turn over here, and we're gonna turn to impeachment with a little important update, touching base with the facts. So the impeachment inquiry, at least the public hearings supposedly are over, at least for now. And so now, it's not a game of actually getting new testimony from people, it's a game of narratives, dueling narratives. What do people actually think about impeachment now that we're past these hearings? You've probably heard, attention is going down, support for impeachment is going down. Just as an example, the Daily Caller, a bastion of truth and reason, said the tide is turning against Democrats on impeachment. And obviously, as we said yesterday in the show, Donald Trump has been just like tweeting what he wants. And here's the thing, Donald Trump is the best, depending on how you look at it, the best or the worst example of just say what you want to be a fact as if it was one. But that's becoming increasingly common. And for people on both sides, as much as I hate to use that term, of the impeachment thing, very often their commentary around what the people want and all of that is very much driven by what they want. They will say that the interest is going down or up just based on what they actually want. So I figured, just briefly, how about we actually look at the evidence rather than just saying what we want to be true? So let's take a look at the overall numbers for support or opposition to impeachment over time with an incredibly complicated graph that you're gonna see right here. Now, what's interesting is very, very consistent numbers going back to April of this year up until the beginning of the Ukraine scandal. You effectively had support and opposition for impeachment that barely budged for month after month after month after month. And then a crazy thing happened, the Ukraine scandal, and it flipped and suddenly more people supported impeachment than opposed it. Now, it is true that a week or two ago, those numbers briefly touched, as you can see on the far right of that. But now, in the past week, they've gone back effectively to where they have been since October. So here's the thing, whichever storyline you're seeing in articles is like, man, people are super hyped up about this, or people are turning against impeachment, the Democrats have really overplayed their hand, how is this gonna hurt them in the 2020 election? It's just not true, neither of those. Here's the truth, people feel pretty much what they felt for the past 2 months about impeachment. And nobody apparently has changed their minds, unless an equal number are switching places during the process. Now, look, if you're a strong supporter of impeaching Trump, that's not necessarily the best news in the world. You would like to think that all of these people coming forward in the public hearings and revealing what they know Donald Trump to have done vis-a-vis Joe Biden and Ukraine looks really bad for him. That should have shifted people more in support of impeachment. But here's the thing, we live in a hell world where nobody cares about anything and facts go to die. And so the fact that nobody changed their minds even as more and more evidence came out, that's just depressing, I guess, but not too distressing because we should be used to it at this point. Now, while we've now established that the numbers have been pretty consistent when it comes to support and opposition for impeachment over the past couple of months, what is really interesting, if you now take this and you compare it to what we know about support or opposition to impeachment over the course of literally the last half century. So here's the crazy thing. Polling has actually been done on how much people want to support impeachment for different presidents going back literally decades. Even if there wasn't an actual impeachment inquiry going forward, people do occasionally ask that question. So whether there was impeachment or not, let's take a look at a couple of the last presidents, see what people think. Way back in the 90s with Clinton in 1998, 29% wanted to impeach him, 67% didn't want to impeach him. So that is far more opposition to impeachment under Clinton, who it feels like, based on my memory, the impeachment inquiry of Clinton lasted for 64 years. So even after all that, it was still very low support. Very similar numbers actually for George W. Bush in 2006. Now he didn't face an actual impeachment process, but they polled it anyway, and that's what it looked like. Very consistent numbers in 2014 for Obama as well. Now, we would occasionally hear about how he needs to be impeached on places like Fox News, Breitbart, Drudge, all of that. But the numbers were pretty opposed to it. And now you see Trump with 50% supporting not only impeaching, but you can see in the beginning, impeaching and removing, and 43% saying not to impeach him. So if you hear someone say, sure, a lot of libs want to impeach Trump, but that's just partisanship. Everybody wants to impeach the other side when they're in power. You can see the numbers there. It's not true. It's actually almost constantly 30% say impeach, 70% say that they don't. Until Donald Trump, he is the historical aberration. And that makes sense because with George W. Bush, Obama, and Clinton, there were lots of concerns, some of which, you know, especially when it comes into war crimes, should have been investigated. But you never had a super high profile scandal that it really made sense to tie to the constitutional imperative to impeach a president. That is just not the case with Donald Trump. People are not having a hard time following this story. Now, that does not mean you're gonna get 60% or 70% or 80% support for impeaching him. That's just not the country that we live in. But you can look at those numbers and see that it's very different than the experience with the three presidents that came before him. And it's actually even worse than that, because we went back to 98 there. Let's jump way earlier and let's compare him to Nixon, a guy who also faced impeachment for very obvious crimes. This is a screenshot from an old New York Times showing 51% in poll favor impeachment, 46% back removal of Nixon. Now, two important facts there. One, the support for both impeachment and removal right now in that CNN poll for Donald Trump is actually 4 points higher than it was for Nixon back then. And importantly, you know when that headline ran? It was 11 days before Nixon left office. Now, I don't bring that up as some might on like the mainstream media and imply, ooh, Donald Trump might suddenly flee. I don't think that's gonna happen. I don't think anything will take him out of that White House, but perhaps even including him losing in 2020. So I don't think he's gonna leave. But this shows that not only is the support for impeachment far higher than it has been, even in the past two decades when we've been a very polarized country, but it's more supportive than they had back with Nixon, a guy who was obviously guilty of horrible crimes. So look, I don't expect this to change your mind about whether he should be impeached or not, but I wanna arm you with the evidence you need that when you're seeing people's narratives that they're trying to push on you, whether from the right or from the center or from the left, here's the actual numbers. This is what the people really think. Okay, stick around, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom, In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So far in this Democratic primary, former President Barack Obama has been very hands-off. He doesn't want to put his finger on the scale, but if a certain candidate suddenly shoots into first place, he's apparently not going to continue that policy. This is according to new reporting from Politico. Publicly, Obama has been clear that he won't intervene in the primary for or against a candidate unless he believed there was some egregious attack. He sees his role as providing guardrails to keep the process from getting too ugly and to unite the party when the nominee is clear. All that sounds okay. There is one potential exception, though. Obama said privately that if Bernie were running away with the nomination, Obama would speak up to stop him. Asked about that, a spokesperson for Obama pointed out that Obama recently said he would support and campaign for whoever the Democratic nominee is. So a bit of a mixed message there. But understand that the second part comes after some damage control might be needed. We're joined now by Jordan Ewell. Jordan, I'm sure that you saw that comment from the former president. What do you think about this like one contingency plan that he's apparently set out?
John, thank you for having me first. But this is just an example of how establishment politics works. So he can, you know, he wants to fight back unless there's an egregious attack. He won't speak out. He won't put his finger on the scales like you mentioned. But you know, hey, if it's the populist candidate who stands to jeopardize this two-party system, this establishment Democratic machine, then he'll throw his hat in the ring and he will get involved. One thing we have to point out is that since leaving office, Obama has been raking in a ton of cash. He had like the $50 million book deal. He was giving speeches to Wall Street. He bought a $15 million estate on Martha's Vineyard. This is a very wealthy person.
Yeah.
And you know, the Sanders plan stands to tax that.
Yeah. And look, you rightly point out his book deal, but as Trump noted on Twitter, also Obama Netflix. So he has some sort of deal there too.
Obama Netflix.
So what I found interesting though, isn't necessarily that behind closed doors, he's like, oh, I don't know about Bernie, but that supposedly it's only Bernie. Like, it's not like, oh, if anyone to the left of Joe Biden gets the nomination, it's not like, oh, Bernie and Warren. It's apparently just Bernie that he feels like he would have to try to like right the ship in his perspective.
Right. I mean, he would speak out against Bernie and Bernie only because Bernie is the only candidate who, again, stands as like a potential threat to the Democratic establishment. He's been the outsider for years. He's been an independent. But that also allows him to speak to these issues that affect people on all sides of the political spectrum, which makes him resonate with so many people. But again, this is just like, you know, the Democratic machine, the establishment wants to have control over the Democratic Party, and especially the primary, as we saw in 2016. Obama's just a cog in that machine. I mean, he may be really well known, he may have been a president, but he's just another piece in that overarching Democratic establishment machine.
Yeah, I would say I know a lot of people who might also be supporters of Bernie Sanders. They might read this and think, good, I welcome your hatred. And I get that, I get that. But I think that in a Democratic primary, I think that Obama still could matter. Like, I think that if he spoke out in support of Biden, it would reassure some people who maybe like watched Biden in a debate and are starting to wonder what's up with him. So I think it could have an effect.
It could. I mean, name recognition goes a long way in politics. People recognize him as the former associate of Joe Biden. Biden was his running mate. I mean, it absolutely could tip the scales. And like you said earlier, Obama says he will support the nominee, whoever that is. But there was the statement was crafted in a way that if it comes down to it in April or May, before the nominee is actually decided, if it's a close race and Bernie is surging, he will absolutely get involved to support whoever the other person or other candidates are.
Yeah.
So he kind of they presented that statement with the caveat that, yeah, he could absolutely still do this, but we're covering our butts now.
We'll have to see. I mean, the idea of him like barnstorming to help out Buttigieg, oh, that should make a lot of people uncomfortable. Okay, let's turn to other news though. Recently, Rick Perry was asked about Donald Trump and some of his many, many, many flaws. And he had this to say about the current president.
God's used imperfect people all through history. King David wasn't perfect. Saul wasn't perfect. Solomon wasn't perfect. And I actually gave the president a little one-pager on those Old Testament kings about a month ago. And I shared it with him. I said, Mr. President, I know there are people that say, you know, you said you were the chosen one. And I said, you were. I said, if you're a believing Christian, you understand God's plan for the people who rule and judge over us on this planet in our government.
So that is Rick Perry, who is, of course, he's now out of the administration. But what did you think about him talking about Trump, not as like the democratically chosen president, but as the guy who God chose to hold that position?
From personal perspective, I mean, I'm agnostic. I really loathe the intermingling of religion and politics, and especially how the religious right has used Christianity as a cudgel over the years. This is deeply alarming. And this also reflects a pattern of increased aggression on this front that Chris Hedges laid out in his early 2000s book, American Fascists. Great read. Everyone should check it out, especially right now. Because what you just saw is the end result of a decades-long campaign by fundamentalist religious organizations to further the cause of Christianity using the Republican Party as a vessel. Mm-hmm. Do you really think that God is deeply invested in American politics, if anything? And by that own logic, if a higher power picked Trump to be the chosen one, couldn't you similarly say the same thing about Obama or Clinton or the Bushes? I mean, this is purely like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think in Rick Perry's defense, there is a portion of the Bible that does talk about someone like Trump, but it's near the end. But then also, like Rick Perry, like from the point of view of a Christian, Rick Perry's 100% right. Everything is according to God's plan. And so based on that, Trump was chosen based on God's plan. But the thing is, like, as you point out, if you were to press him, I bet he would say, then yes, Obama is also there because of God's plan. But the thing is, they don't talk about it when it's a Democrat. Suddenly it's not like, yes, the will of God in the White House. It's only when it's a Republican that it becomes this big thing that they feel like they need to talk about.
Right. I mean, if you remember, Obama was a self-professed Christian. He went to Reverend Wright's church, which became its own scandal in itself because of his comments. But despite all that, they still claimed he was a Muslim. And this is just part of this dominionist, this fundamentalist view from religious right, where, you know, this is God's plan and it's only for us. And everything to our left is secular. Anything science-based needs to be eradicated. We have this view. This is a dominionist, you know, this is God's plan. It's deeply alarming that it has gotten this far. And also the people that are furthering these viewpoints and have been for years, Trump is not only like, you know, blowing kisses and winking at them, he's inviting them into the White House.
Yeah.
He just hired Paula White. This is really, really scary, and it is only going to get worse from here.
I agree. Now, the fun part, because that was Rick Perry as of this week talking about Trump being the chosen one. Rick Perry back in 2015, though, he was talking about Trump in kind of different terms. Take a look at this.
The White House has been occupied by giants, but from time it is sought by the small-minded, the divisive figures, propelled by anger, appealing to the worst instincts in the human condition. A barking carnival act that can best be described as Trumpism. a toxic mix of demagoguery and mean-spiritedness and nonsense that will lead the Republican Party to perdition if pursued. Let no one be mistaken. Donald Trump's candidacy is a cancer on conservatism, and it must be clearly diagnosed, excised, and discarded. Donald Trump was born into privilege. He received deferments to avoid service in Vietnam. He breathed the free air thousands of heroes died protecting. And he couldn't have endured for 5 minutes what John McCain endured for 5.5 years. My fellow Republicans, beware of false prophets.
So, two things. One, really fast, that's the most articulate Rick Perry has literally ever been in his entire life. And two, that's harsher than I've ever been of Donald Trump, I think, on this program.
Yeah, I mean, some pretty strong words there from Rick Perry. But of course, he's done a complete and total 180 now that he stands to benefit from Trump in the White House. This just shows that, like, the Republican Party is a party full of demagogues who have, you know, no spine, no morals, no integrity. They all are careerists, self-serving, self-aggrandizing. And we've seen this not just from Rick Perry, but other people like Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz, who were so outspoken about the dangers of Donald Trump. We can't elect this guy. It's so bad. Oh, but now he's in the White House. He's our buddy. He's our guy. God picked him to run the country.
Yeah.
They stand for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, by the way, it's not even inconsistent. Like, Rick Perry could both believe it's God's plan and Trump is a horrible, horrible, horrible person. But maybe you don't have to speak about him in such flowery terms now. You could be consistent. But what we have noticed over the past few years, as you pointed out, with a lot of these people is over time, those who are opposed to Donald Trump, they still want to be in on the power on the right. And to do that, you have to be supportive of Donald Trump at this point.
Of course.
Now, really briefly, let's touch on one more story. It is not often in America that any elected politician admits that they were wrong. I'm talking about Democrats and Republicans. And we actually have an instance of it today. And so I want to give this person a tiny bit of credit, the only credit I will ever give them. So this is Senator Joe Kennedy. So he had been on Fox News Sunday, and Chris Wallace had been talking about the hacking of the DNC server. And Chris Wallace had said, let me just interrupt to say the entire intelligence community says it was Russia. And Senator John Kennedy said, right, but it could also be Ukraine. Which is nonsense. It's the sort of nonsense that some on the right believe, but no one who has actually looked into this believes. But to his credit, he was on Cuomo's show, and this is what he had to say.
Now, Chris is right. I was wrong. The only evidence I have, and I think it's overwhelming, is that it was Russia who tried to hack the DNC computer.
That's what the consensus is.
I've seen no indication that Ukraine tried to do it.
Now, we'll have to see how he weasels out of this, if there's some pressure from Donald Trump or something like that. But really, I mean, he not only changed his position to be in line with the facts, but he said, I was wrong. And that is not something that we see very often.
No, we definitely do not see that. I think what happened was he got his conspiracies confused. The right has been pushing this narrative that Andrea Chalupa and the DNC colluded with Ukraine to take down Trump and take down Manafort, which has led to, like, as I know her sister really well, has led to a ton of harassment, stalking, threats. I mean, just the onslaught of targeted harassment that this person has received as a result of this right-wing, like, conspiracy is super alarming, and no one ever talks about that. But what happened with Kennedy, it seems, is he got those two things confused and also thought he was going to be in a favorable interview because it was on Fox News. Mm-hmm. But it was just, like, so demonstrably false that he had no choice but to admit he was wrong. Which, sure, it's good he did that, and we should celebrate it. But that's all we should celebrate him for.
Yeah, exactly. I want to provide positive incentives when someone does the right thing. I'm not saying he's great, or you should vote for him, or anything like that. I'll probably never say another positive thing about him on this show. But I respect when people can admit that they were wrong. But we will see if he gets booted out of the Republican Party later this week. Jordan Ewell, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
John, thank you for having me.
Stick around, more after this. Yesterday, a report came out, including analysis by a number of different economists about the likely impact of student loan debt cancellation. And they concluded that it would boost the economy in significant ways and help combat income inequality, which should not surprise anyone. Yes, let's take tens of millions of people and allow them to actually be a part of the economy and maybe purchase a home someday, actually get a car, rather than just signing massive checks that are a significant chunk of their entire income over to a tiny little bank that's not gonna do anything. That seems pretty obvious, and it really shouldn't be a shock to people because more and more candidates are now embracing some form of debt cancellation. We're joined actually now by one of those candidates, Jose Caballero, joining us once again, congressional candidate for the 53rd District in California. Jose, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. I love being on the show.
It's great to have you here. So look, they've concluded it would be helpful to the economy. It would be a big stimulus. Are you surprised by this?
No, not at all. I mean, people around, you know, in the generation, our millennial generation, they can't buy homes, they can't start businesses, they can't have children because they just don't have the income and they have these looming, you know, debts over their head that is just completely crippling them from even moving forward and keeping them in their jobs. So it doesn't surprise me at all. In fact, I'm surprised that it didn't come out sooner.
Well, so as of right now, there are two of the top four candidates in the Democratic primary are supporting some form of debt cancellation. You have Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. Their plans are a little bit different. Bernie's is sort of just a in one fell swoop. Warren's has sort of tiers where the more you make, the less cancellation you get, so that it focuses its efforts on people who make less than $250,000 a year. I know that if you make it into Congress, you're going to want to be involved in these conversations. So from your point of view, based on your experience and research, what's the best path forward for doing cancellation?
The best path forward is just to eliminate it all across the board. Mm-hmm. Because people that, you know, lawyers, doctors, people who get higher education, you know, professors, they have to go to school for a long, long time and they shouldn't be punished for taking these professional careers. So we shouldn't have a cancellation cap. Because what that cap does is it forces people to leave education sooner than they want to before they even want to, you know, pursue a deeper education. So I think that we should have complete cancellation and then followed by college for all to make sure that we no longer have debts happening anymore. So that's what I would be fighting for.
So you are a veteran. We know that many veterans hold significant student loan debt. From your experience as a veteran, what do you think about the likely impact of debt cancellation? How would it affect that community in particular?
It would affect us in a very deep way. I actually have student loan debt myself because the post 9/11 GI Bill for education only spans 36 months of actual education time. So if you're coming out of the military and you go right into education, you know, you do a 4-year degree and your money is spent. So then you have to go into graduate school, which is very, very expensive. So that's where my debt came from, was I took a year of graduate school. I actually didn't do another year of graduate school because the debt was so high, I just didn't want to take on more. So that actually made a big impact in my life. There's also veterans that are going in the military with student loan debt as well, that are trying to get like special payment plans for them. They forgo their own bonuses to just go and just pay off their student loan debt. So I think that's a big issue too, if you have military veterans going into the military just to pay off their student loan debt, which otherwise they may not join the military, which also creates a negative, hostile environment within the military ranks itself.
100%. It creates really weird financial incentives to do something that should not be based on finances. Finally, I just want to say one thing that I say often when this comes up. I'm lucky enough that I have freed myself of my student loan debt. I did.
Lucky crazy, you.
Thank you. And it involved a decade of effectively that was my only financial priority. And I know that every time I tweet about student loan debt cancellation, probably on the tweets that we're going to generate from this appearance, Jose, someone's going to respond with, well, I paid off my student loan debt, why should other people have it canceled? And I will say that as a person who has already taken care of mine, the idea that I would stop other people from being freed of that burden just because it doesn't benefit me is, it's so bizarre. It's like a perverse alien way of thinking. People are suffering. They would be better off. The country would be better off. How am I going to let my own financial situation, my own weird ex post facto greed stop those people from being helped? I just can't think like that.
You know, it's almost like, hey, I worked for it, why can't you? Like, I had to pay extra time and do it, so therefore everyone needs to suffer. Well, people don't realize if we continue this cycle of suffering that we have to go through as Americans, apparently, we are not gonna advance our economy forward. It's a really, like you said, a very selfish way of thinking that is like, hey, if I suffer, you better suffer.
Exactly.
And that is not a good way to think at all.
I agree. Let's turn to another topic now. We've been talking recently about Donald Trump's, in my view, war on the military, or at least the military leadership, over his campaign now to absolve alleged war criminals of the crimes they've committed, generally as a result of right-wing Fox News-led campaigns to get them absolved. And Eddie Gallagher, we've been talking about. I'm not a veteran. Jose Caballero, you are. As you've been watching this story, what do you think about Donald Trump's kind of like historic effort to make sure that there's no consequences for people who've been accused of incredibly significant war crimes?
Well, what it does is it completely destroys military cohesion. It disrupts the ability for our highest ranking officers to run our military the way that it's supposed to be. So for example, it is against military code and regulation to be political and go out into TV as an active duty member, to go out and say, oh, I'm going to speak out on this issue or this candidate, and that is not allowed. But now what is happening is because there is almost no rule of law, even in our own military ranks. If you feel like you're being abused and you think that conservative media is going to be able to help you out, you can go to Fox and Friends and speak directly to the president and completely just undermine the entire chain of command. You know, to completely eliminate or to have the Secretary of the Navy leave is a huge problem, because that completely just throws all of the chain of command into disarray, because now we don't have a leader right now at the moment. We have somebody that steps in, but now we have to figure out what are the new objectives, what is the new Secretary of the Navy going to do? And this is just, I mean, I am so shocked that this happened. I did not think that we would see the day where the president of the United States is taking specific actions on military cases when they're involving war crimes, that are dealing with the sailors themselves, the SEALs themselves, that said this person is wrong, and completely denying all of that to force our highest ranking Navy officer out, which is the Secretary of the Navy, out is. I mean, it's hard to even fathom like what the cascading problems this is going to create, especially for people who want to join the military and be like, hey, I can just shoot up people and completely be not held accountable for it. And it is a big problem.
Yeah, not held accountable and possibly become some sort of like hero to the right wing if I shoot the right sort of people. And if you're watching this and you want more details on these individual cases, we've got multiple videos on the YouTube channel where we've broken them down. I will add only one other thing that I learned since the last video was that some of his fellow SEALs, this is in the case of Eddie Gallagher, said that they had tampered with the optics on his rifle so that he would be less accurate, so that he would miss civilians when he tried to shoot them. And they were willing to have a guy fighting on their side who they wouldn't be able to count on to shoot the actual enemy because they were so worried that he would be shooting civilians. And that is just mind-blowing.
Yes, it is. And you know, so the military has a process, and it's supposed to get people like these out of the Navy, and that is what they're supposed to be doing. So you know, that is the major crux of this, is that the Navy was doing exactly what it was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. Get out people like Gallagher and set an example for other SEALs and other military members to say this type of actions will not be tolerated, and you'll be punished justly, and you'll remove all of your honors and awards that you receive because you're a war criminal. And we cannot, I mean, and again, this is just gonna create more havoc.
Yeah, and look, this Eddie Gallagher thing has proved that if you're a veteran who do things the wrong way, you can possibly become a bit of a hero to the right. I want to incentivize veterans who do the right thing. So Jose, so far as I know, you've never committed a war crime.
Yeah.
So you're running for office right now. Give us a little update on how that campaign's going.
Yeah, so this campaign, since Susan Davis has dropped out of the race, which is the 20-year incumbent, we have now 19, possibly 20 people that are going to be on this ballot. And wow. it's insanity. We have this huge power vacuum. So what happened at the last Democratic Party convention at Long Beach was it was the establishment choice being anointed the Democratic Party nominee for this race. So what this shows is that a Democratic establishment candidate cannot win on their own merit. They have to have these unfair advantages to make sure that they can win. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars in mailers, the local Democratic Party establishment that is going to now support them. This is a big, big problem. And we need to be able to fight back, because this is really what stopping progressives from being able to succeed is because progressive candidates are being stifled by the own community when they call themselves Democrats. The Democrats, 50 people in a room, will decide for the entire district of over, you know, half a million people. Yeah. So it's insane.
Well, and I know that in your race, you've got a bit of a deadline coming up. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I do. Yes. So we have the filing deadline for getting in our money for our ballot statement and getting onto the ballot. This is probably the most critical thing that we can absolutely do right now. So we are going to be going against the billionaires. We're going to be going against the establishment. And we need your donations more than ever. JoseForCongress.us. If you want progressives to win that support Medicare for all with the elimination of private health insurance, to make sure that we have cancellation of student loan debt, student loan and college for all, the Heroes Promise, which is a military veteran bill of rights that is going to protect veterans. I'm sorry, my dog's going crazy. We're going to protect veterans to make sure that we actually have power. So what we need you to do, and this is the TYT audience can agree. The TYT audience can agree that if you want a progressive candidate in office, you have to donate $5, $2, $1, whatever you can do to make sure that we get on the ballot. That is key and front and center. This is the most important thing that could happen. Go to JoseForCongress.us to make sure that we can win this.
Well, your dog is obviously fired up about
the
chances.
Yes, he got all excited about that.
And Jose, we always appreciate you joining us. You know, best of luck with the deadline, and thanks again for coming on the show today.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Stick around, more after this. Just a couple of months ago, the operators of a popular pornographic video website, Girls Do Porn, were charged with trafficking and conspiracy involving a number of different women who say that they were defrauded, even raped by the operators of this site. And joining us now is contributor to The Appeal, Meg O'Connor, to break this down. Meg, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So for people who might not have seen the initial reporting over these charges being filed, what's basically the heart of the situation?
So essentially, these guys who were running Girls Do Porn, they had a really concerted effort to kind of trick women into filming pornography. They would seek out college-age women. They would post Craigslist ads in college towns where they said that they were seeking models aged like 18 to 22. The ad itself would take girls often to a website called beginmodeling.com, where they'd be greeted with still images of fashion models, and it would look very much like they were applying for a modeling job. Some women, after they applied, would get callbacks from the men running the website. And at sometimes they would learn at that point that they would actually be filming pornography. Sometimes they wouldn't learn until they flew out to San Diego. But all of the women were told that the videos they would be filming would never be posted online. They were told that the videos would be sent to on DVD only to private collectors in Australia and New Zealand, where the men, two of the men who ran Girls Do Porn, Michael Pratt and Matthew Wolf, were from. So they essentially agreed to film these videos on the basis that nobody would ever see them. They never knew that they were filming videos for GirlsDoPorn.com, which was a wildly popular website and was featured prominently on Pornhub, one of the most trafficked websites in the world. So that's essentially the basis. And it was beyond that, the ringleaders of Girls Do Porn would even pay other women to act as references to lie to the women, the prospective women, and say that they had filmed a video and that nothing had ever happened. Meanwhile, they had never filmed a video and they knew that these videos would be published online. Wow. So all of that is the basis for the fraud and conspiracy charges. And
so all of that is obviously horrendous. But in addition, a number of women apparently going back to even 2015 were filing complaints about their experience. And it seems like the police were entirely uninterested in actually pursuing it.
Yeah, there at least three women as far back as 2015 reported to the police their experiences with Girls Do Porn. They were all in different jurisdictions under different circumstances. So one woman in San Diego reported it. She was actually tagged in an Instagram post on Girls Do Porn's account. It was a photo of her sitting on the hotel room. And, you know, she's thinking this video is never going to be published anywhere. And all of a sudden she's tagged in an Instagram post saying this video is coming soon. So she went to San Diego, the San Diego Police Department, and tried to sort of preventatively file a report, trying to get this video to never come out. Obviously, that didn't happen. And there's another woman in Newport Beach, California, who went to police after the fact and said that she had been sexually assaulted by the actor in the films, Andre Garcia. And that's also something that made it into the federal indictment. Prosecutors allege that Garcia sexually assaulted several of the women who filmed these videos. And in the civil case as well, at least six women say that they were raped by Garcia.
And so, I mean, I'm assuming as this goes forward, hopefully we'll find out a little bit more about what was happening internally in the police departments. But I mean, my suspicion as a relative newcomer to the story is these are exactly the sort of women who can least expect any sort of assistance from the police, no matter how bad what's happening to them is. Does it seem as if it's just, you signed up for this in one way or another? I'm obviously putting it in callous terms, but is this a case where the police just didn't care considering the nature of the work?
It certainly seems, you know, there's not a lot to go off of the few reports that were made, but it certainly seems to be the case that it just wasn't, it was in the one instance with Newport Beach, it was not investigated at all. The case was essentially closed. All the officer said was based on a lack of identifying information. I can't determine where the crime occurred or who the suspect was, but the woman had given the police officer her phone, which had text messages between Garcia, emails from the recruiters, and that sort of thing. And instead, in the police report, he focused on what she was wearing the day that she was raped. He Wow. wrote down she had not been wearing a bra and wrote down the color of her thong. So it certainly didn't seem like the priority there was the assault that occurred.
Can I ask you a question? You did a write-up about this case on The Appeal several weeks ago. And I know when I have done videos about these sorts of topics involving exploitation of sex workers in one form or another, or maybe state-level efforts to increase protections for people in this line of work, I have been extremely disappointed in the reaction. And it seems like the historic stigma against people in this line of work, if there has been improvement, it is difficult to perceive. I'm curious about the response to your write-up about this case.
Well, there is always a certain, you know, sect of people who are going to say, well, they decided to film porn, so they deserve it. Whatever came after that, that was their fault. And that's a really just an awful way to think about it. I wouldn't say that is like largely the response. Largely the response was sympathy for these, you know, the 18, like you it's very easy to be tricked at that age. There's a lot of sympathy for the women in these cases, but yeah, there is certainly a response of like, well, if you accept having sex for money or having sex on film for money, then you almost kind of deserve everything that comes after that, which is, you know, makes it sexual assault in general is a very underreported crime and is difficult for any victim to come forward and report. But especially in cases involving any kind of sex work, there's just this whole added stigma to it that makes it even more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say in advance of the comments on this video, if you are a guy who says there is no difference between recording a private video that will never go public and suddenly finding out that it's on literally the biggest website in the entire world, imagine if that video was of you. You might find that there's a little bit of a difference in that particular case. In any event, Meg O'Connor, thank you so much. Really enjoyed the write-up. And then perhaps we can touch base a little bit later on as the case develops.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. The civil case is just wrapping up and the criminal case is going forward. So
thank you. We'll be following it and we really appreciate your work.
Of course. Thanks so much.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. Stick around. So I teased the koala story. We are going to have that. And also Donald Trump, I know I say this a lot, maybe I'm overselling it, but I think this morning he said the dumbest thing he's ever said. So we're going to have that, but it's going to be in an overtime. And so you're going to want to check that out. You can do that. If you're a member, you'll be able to watch live, or you can find it on the YouTube channel a little bit later on or on the podcast. It's not going to be in this live show on the linear platforms. But before we get to that, really fast, just a couple things I wanted to do. I'm always encouraging you guys, if you listen to the podcast, to review it on iTunes. It's very important for new people to discover the show. It's just about the best thing you can do. And so I'm very appreciative anytime someone either rates it at 5 stars or leaves a review. There was a review recently from Johnny3, who said, much love, John. I hope you have ways to prevent passion fatigue. Your integrity and humanity in covering the news is heartwarming. Much love. Thank you, Johnny, for saying that. I will say I have not really figured out, I mean, what you're saying with passion fatigue, not being sort of burned out on the news. It happens to pretty much everyone at TDR. I imagine most people in the news, whether you're in front of the camera or behind it, we have to cover a lot of depressing and dark stuff at times. You know, but I have a great partner, I have a great dog, and you know, I try to take a little bit of time off and not let it follow me, you know, home necessarily on all days. So those things do help, and I really do appreciate that review that you left. So with that, we are going to take a short break. We're gonna come back for the overtime. Again, if you're a member, you'll be able to follow that, so you definitely should. Oh, also, by the way, we do quick live videos before the live show on our YouTube channel. And so if you're not already subscribed, do that. Every morning before the show, we do a quick live video. I'll see you on the other side for the overtime. Bounce with the rhythm, go. Recently, a series of brush fires have been devastating a section of Australia, and it's been particularly harsh on koalas living there. You might have seen this video floating around the internet involving a koala named Lewis. Take a look.
Can you move back?
So obviously that's just a devastating video to watch. And it's a reminder of, you know, we have these fires in Australia. There were terrible fires last year in Europe, California. And we've had entire towns burned up. People die, huge amounts of animals as well, even here in California. Now, tragically, that koala, Lewis, later succumbed to its injuries. It had to be put down because it couldn't survive the amount of damage that was done to it from these fires. And it goes beyond even Lewis, as tragic as the one is. The chairman of the Australian Koala Foundation estimates that over 1,000 koalas have been killed from the fires, and that 80% of their habitat has been destroyed. And looking to the future, recent bushfires, along with prolonged drought and deforestation, has led to koalas becoming, quote, functionally extinct, according to the Australian Koala Foundation. So that does not mean that there are no koalas left, but it means that in the very near future, that is entirely possible. Functional extinction is when a population becomes so limited that they no longer play a significant role in their ecosystem, and the population becomes no longer viable. While some individuals could produce, the limited number of koalas makes the long-term viability of the species unlikely and highly susceptible to disease, because as you have less diversity, even if their population was to recover to some extent, there's less resistance to disease in future generations. And in terms of the number of deaths that can be expected in the near future, because their prime source of food, the eucalyptus that supposedly each koala eats on average about 2 pounds per day, they will recover, but it might take months or even longer for that to happen. And in the meantime, many koalas will simply starve to death. Now, this is not a universal opinion. There are some that believe that the situation for koalas is not quite so dark, but it is possible that this could be the beginning of the end for that species. And look, by itself, That's devastating. And if you would like to do something to help, there is a charity GoFundMe set up, Help Thirsty Koalas Devastated by Recent Fires. It has raised quite a bit of money. And there's a push inside of Australia for legislation that would be designed to help protect them in the future. But it goes beyond the koalas. This is a terrible tale, but it's also a cautionary tale. Because it is likely that unless we pass something like a Green New Deal and rally countries around the world to do something about climate change, the sorts of conditions that lead to fires like this will become more common. And a story, you know, this month it's koalas functionally extinct. For the rest of our lives, we will see stories like that. The end of one species of plant or one animal that will no longer be there. An inability to, you know, do agriculture in a particular country. That will be the story of climate change. Yes, it will be increased heat on average and rising oceans, but it will also be the destruction of habitats and species. And we might one day look back and say, hey, remember koalas? Remember these animals that we used to have? Let's not create a future where that's the way we look back on creatures like Lewis and the rest of his species. So let's take this seriously. Let's protect these species, but let's also go beyond that and do something serious to deal with climate change to make these sorts of wildfires less likely to happen in the future. Okay, let's turn now to very different news. Big tone shift too, because this gets ridiculous. Donald Trump was signing legislation. It's for Women's Suffrage Centennial Coin Act. And here is what he had to say about it.
I've been working on this for years and years, and I'm curious, why wasn't it done a long time ago? And also, well, I guess the answer to that is because now I'm president, we get things done. We get a lot of things done that nobody else got done.
That's real dumb. That's real, real dumb. Why weren't they able to get the Women's Suffrage Centennial Coin Act done earlier? Why didn't Obama do it 6 years ago? Where was Clinton to pass the Women's Suffrage Centennial Coin Act? Yes, why did these Democrats not act for the anniversary that happens next year? Why didn't they do that? And it's, you know, it's great that we finally have Trump who's taking bold action and finally getting this done. But is this where it should stop? Sure, we got the Women's Suffrage Centennial Coin Act, but Trump, where are you on the Bicentennial Coin Act? I mean, if we leave it to the Democrats, it could take 100 years to get that passed. What about the tricentennial? Are we gonna wait 200 years to get that passed, Trump? Why don't you act now? I want 1,000 years of recognition for women's suffrage. Now look, obviously the event is super important and responsible politicians who actually know what they're talking about passed it, as they should. But Donald Trump is so dead set on this narrative that only he can get these things done, that he's applying it to situations where it doesn't exist at all. And look, we cut off the video there, but he passes to a woman speaker, she starts talking. And I get that she has to just go on with her prepared remarks, but don't you wish she had stopped and said, hey dummy, dingus, think about what you're saying. This is more important than just you. This isn't about you finally being the one to break through. This is about recognition for something, women's suffrage that should have happened much earlier in American history, and it has nothing to do with you or any other male politician. Anyway, maybe I'm wrong, maybe this isn't the dumbest thing that he's said, but it certainly merits inclusion on maybe the top 10 or top 20. Okay, that's all the time we have for our overtime. Thank you so much for joining me, not only for the full show, but also for this little extra we've got for you. Tomorrow on the show, Brett Ehrlich and Francesca Fiorentini are gonna be in studio to lead you through an hour. I will be back after Thanksgiving, so have a great set of holidays, and I'll see you later. But the show continues tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Derola. I'll see you soon.